Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Scott Nakagawa from The Nation magazine will explain how COVID-19 has fueled the white nationalist movement, resulting in anti-Asian violence and conspiracy theories. Josh Kavensky from Talking Points Memo will discuss the chaos that has been unleashed by a federal government that is procuring personal protection equipment for hospitals based on private profit instead of public need. And Dave Zirin from the Edge of Sports podcast will get us up to date with all the COVID-19 related stories involving the sports world. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor, support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. You'll get the full show, all of what you're missing every week. And here to start off the program with the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, another week, tragedy, there is farce, then there's more tragedy in many respects, and then just a lot of just, you know, sheer insanity that's going on. That is the world that we're living in. We're dealing now with over 60,000 Americans have died. Over 1 million have been infected. It is really unclear. We have a million recorded cases. We don't really know how many cases that we've had in the country, because a significant portion of those will be asymptomatic. There are, you know, guesstimates based upon some very rough surveys of people. It's possible the infection rate in New York City could have been and could be as high as 20-25%. My suspicion is it's on the low end of that, but I think it could be 15-20%. And then around the country, it could be 5%. This is important to note because there's only really two ways that this ends, and that is through a vaccination or through herd immunity. And vaccination, you know, at the earliest is going to be 18 months off. And then who knows? Maybe, I mean, I've seen estimates that say 5-10 years. Herd immunity, it would come at the cost of, you know, close to 1 million Americans' lives. People can do the math more or less on this. And that's if we do it in a sort of almost controlled way, and that would take some time as well. In the meantime, we're just trying to, what would be nice is to get some broad principles so that we could not necessarily go back to pre-COVID, but to sort of begin to live with this for, you know, an interim period of time as our economy and sort of the social fabric is beginning to fray. The economy is a disaster. I just don't think that we realize it yet. So with all of that going on, that is sort of just, that's just our context. There's a lot of news within that context at this point, not the least of which is, I think, you know, on top of everything that's happening with the Trump administration and what they're doing with the red states and why the red states are doing this and how they're beginning to slowly really screw working people and broadly all of us, short of corporations, many people obviously are paying a lot of attention to the election and the polling on one hand, and on the other hand, this burgeoning, I don't know what you call this, controversy around Joe Biden regarding Tara Reid. I think you and I have mentioned it a little bit in the past, but it got the story got at least more corroboration this week. An investigative piece by his first name escapes me, but McHugh, who was a producer who worked with Ronan Farrow. So a lot of respect within the sort of like journalistic industry, and talking to a former neighbor of Tara Reid's, who said Yeah, I remember her telling me about this in 1993, and this is someone who is a Biden supporter, ostensibly. Where are we at with this, Heather?
Well, I mean, this is a very tough situation, I think, for progressive women to deal with for obvious reasons. You know, I don't think anybody wants to be dealing with something like this in the middle of the crisis that you just described, which is, you know, kind of world-ending. And this isn't something, but it must be dealt with. It has to be. It is part of our you know, our reality. And so I have several thoughts on it. And I don't, you know, obviously I don't know all the facts. I don't think anybody does. But to the extent we know them, what we know about it, you know, as a feminist and a, you know, a progressive woman, I mean, this is disturbing. It's a disturbing, you know, sort of illustration of the kind of, you know, this same kind of thing that we've been seeing through the whole Me Too era here, where, you know, you're finding out that you know, men who were ostensibly, you know, sort of normal behaving men, you find out that, you know, in private moments were not like that. And I was working, not in Washington in the early 90s, but I'm old enough to have been working. I was a working woman in the early 90s in a corporate setting. And I can tell you that it's absolutely true that men that you didn't expect to have behaved in these sorts of ways, whether it's harassment or, I suppose, assault as well, did, you know, the nice family man, the guy who supposedly is just a regular guy, and suddenly you find out that there's all these, you know, instances of them doing these sorts of things when they, because they could get away with it. And I'll just say right up front, as a feminist, I'm sick of it, and I am tired of having to deal with this over and over and over again. But I will also say that I'm a civil libertarian, and I believe in due process, and I believe in looking at evidence, and I don't The whole idea of, you know, what we were saying, believe women, I don't think it ever should have been believe women. It's, we should respectfully listen to women and take their complaints seriously and their charges seriously and look at it, you know, instead of dismissing them, as has been done for decades, maybe centuries, you know, millennia. The whole system that was sort of rose up around sexual assault, sexual harassment, and this idea that you could sweep this stuff under the rug, that had to change, that you had to be looking at these things from the, you know, the standpoint of taking it as seriously as you would any other crime, instead of sort of making the assumption, which I think the assumption was, well, you know, she's making it up, or she's a liar, or whatever. I mean, this would happen unless a woman was, you know, beaten to a pulp. They didn't even, you know, necessarily even want to entertain the idea that this might have happened, particularly with famous and important men. So, you know, I absolutely believe in that. But having said that, you know, you have to have some due process. There's a reason why we had the statute of limitations. There are reasons why there needed to be truly, you know, contemporaneous accounts. And in this case, you know, the neighbor who was revealed this week, it wasn't contemporaneous. It was several years later. And there are a lot of things about her story that are questionable. And I'm not saying she's not telling the truth, but I am saying that if you are a civil libertarian, you can't look at a case like this and just say it's open and shut, that there's no problem. So I am keeping an open mind on that. As I said, as a feminist, I'm sick of this stuff. And if this is the way it goes, this is the way it goes for Joe Biden. But I am also keeping an open mind on the fact that there are perhaps, you know, some reasons that we might not be aware of, whether it's political or some kind of an agenda, that could be driving some of this. Finally, I'll just say this. My political analysis of this is absolutely horrifying. Because what I see is the idea that, you know, Joe Biden, he may drop out or, you know, be forced to drop out or doesn't drop out. And what we wind up with is a horrible fight, a delegate fight in the middle of July in a virtual, half-baked, complete shit show of a convention, and it will not be easy to choose a replacement. And that has me absolutely terrified, because that if the Democrats can do one thing, focus on one thing and one thing alone, it's that they are going to be the more competent, captain at the helm of this horrifying situation we're in and try to get us out of it. Because with 30 million people unemployed right now, and how many of them are even going to be back at work in July? I don't know.
None.
But the idea that the Democrats show themselves to be just doing a complete, having a fight over a 30-year-old, allegation that is probably unprovable, and then they go through this. I just think that's devastating for the Democratic Party. For the chances of winning. I think we could still win. I think they could still do it, but it's just like throwing up every roadblock in the world here to make it happen. And that just has me tossing and turning and losing sleep at night. So I hope there's some kind of resolution to this that doesn't get us to that convention. I really do.
I mean. Okay, so, I'm with you. I don't think it is obvious one way or another in terms of whether Biden was guilty of this. I really don't. I do think that it is not obvious at all that this is a fake allegation. Let's put it that way to me. And so this is a serious allegation. I think it has credibility. That doesn't necessarily mean it's correct. It is not hard for me to imagine that a senator in 1993, thought that this woman was interested in him and thought that this was an appropriate way to, respond to that belief. It's not inconceivable to me that that's the way that he approached that. I mean, the thing that sticks in my craw about this whole thing, and I do not think that we're ever going to be able to know the truth of this. I just don't think it's possible. And I don't know that there can be I don't know what the preponderance of the evidence would be if it was ever to go to trial, which it won't. But one thing that does stick out in my mind is that something happened at that time. And what it is, we don't know, but it caused her to lose her responsibilities in the office. Now, the range of what those things were could be, and her mother apparently thought it was a problem. I think that's the word she used when she called into Larry King. And that could mean Joe Biden did what he did, or he did something along those lines. Or it could mean that Tara Reid was in some way like inappropriate in the work that she did and therefore was demoted, by the, or maybe. There was something that was a problem that at the very least Tara Reid went home and said there was a problem at work. And there was we know there was a problem because she also lost. We know from the interns that she managed that there was something there. And what strikes me is that there has been the only response from the Biden staff was don't remember anything about it. Don't remember that there was a problem. Whether they were talking about, Joe Biden doing something inappropriate or Tara Reid doing something inappropriate. But something clearly happened. And so that to me just says, like, we need to resolve that question. Like, why did they take action like they did at that time? And that to me, there should be notes, right? Like, I mean, because in 1993, if you're working on the Hill and you're going to demote somebody, There should be some type of paper trail about why you did that. And, I want to know what that is. Now, I don't know if it's knowable. There's papers at his, library, but they aren't necessarily organized or anything like that. So who knows? But so let's just look at it this way. There's two scenarios. One is Joe Biden did what he was accused of. And the other scenario is that he didn't. Right? I mean, one of those two things is true. And I'm not sure, because we can't know definitively, how much, you know, from a just a strictly like ethical perspective, we can make an assessment as to what to do about that. Right? Yep. Because, you know, I just don't know what, you know, what we can do. And I don't know that we can say with, even 80% assuredness this happened. And I don't think we can say with 80% assuredness this didn't happen. I'm not even sure we can say it with like 55% on either way. I mean, I just don't know. But we can assess it from a political perspective. And there is enough corroboration, it seems to me, that this won't be ignored. You know, I mean, 2 weeks ago, I talked about this. I think you and I talked about it. And my feeling was like, I suspect this goes away. It may not be the right thing. It might not be the moral thing or ethical. But I suspect the Democratic voters don't care. But we are getting to a point with the story that there is enough information that it might be very, very hard to ignore from any perspective. Like, it might begin to impact Democratic voters who were going to vote for Joe Biden before.
I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to impact. For one thing, there is no doubt that the right wing is on this. There is not. They're talking about nothing else. I mean, this is if you go to any right wing website or you watch Fox News, this is all over it. And that, so we know that about them, and we know that that there are plenty of people on the left who are upset about this and who are also extremely concerned. Where we're in the rock and a hard place here is that I suspect that there are a lot of people, and I think if you look at the Fire Chris Hayes hashtag, that you're going to see a lot of people on the Democratic side who are also on the other side of it saying, you can't talk about it, I don't want to hear about it, don't you dare do this, Joe Biden is our, is our only hope, and how dare you, do this thing in the middle of this horrible situation. I mean, and the fact is, I mean, this is how I look at it, if this were a normal primary, we'd still be in the primaries, or at least more or less in the primaries. I doubt that Sanders would have, dropped out at this, in April. It was a normal primary. We're coming up to a normal convention. We're going to run against Donald Trump in the fall, and there was no pandemic. I absolutely feel it would be entirely possible that Joe Biden would just drop out over this because it would be too much, and then the strain would be too much. Or if not, there would be a strong push to get him out. Or maybe even shift the results of the later primaries that would still be coming up to somebody else, and maybe there would then be a real delegate fight. But I could easily see this because, it is serious enough. It is something that is being talked about. There's no avoiding it. That in a normal, campaign season, I think this would be, truly devastating to Joe Biden. But we're not, obviously. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and the world economy is cratering right now. And we have, people dying in massive numbers. So that puts this whole thing into a different perspective. And that's where I'm sitting as somebody who, I mean, I don't care about Biden. I never liked him. I have no loyalty to the guy. I don't love politicians in general. I mean, to me, I make them all women so we don't ever have to deal with this again. I'd be fine with that. But because we're in this dire situation, the calculation here, the moral calculation, if not the political calculation, is different than it normally would be. And so I'm sitting here going, I don't know what's going to happen here. I can't predict it. I really can't. I could predict it if we were in a normal situation, but I can't. So, I don't know what to say about it, Sam. I mean, this is very, very difficult. I mean, it really is I mean, it's bothering me a lot because I don't honestly know where this goes. But I do know that if the Democrats don't figure out a way to deal with this, and I'm talking about the Biden campaign, they've got to respond in some way. This is they can't let this go on because they've got to figure out a way to approach this within the actual, you know, parameters of the world we're living in. And I grant you, it's hard, but they have to do it. I mean, this is what leadership is. And if he doesn't do it, then I think we're facing a November that could be even worse.
Just to try and eke out a sliver of a silver lining here. It is good that we're doing this in April, right?
Yes.
And as opposed to June and August and September. Now there's another element, but I want to circle back to what you said, because I think that to me is the key. There could be more of these people, right? We don't know. We don't know.
It would be likely more people.
Look at how long it took to get, with Donald Trump. There's 20 women, I think, at least on the record now, accusing him of one form of assault or another. One who accused him of rape in a retail outlet. She didn't come out until late,
last year.
Yeah. And so, it's not like all of these women who are out there, they may be motivated by how they see Tara Reid treated. And we are still early enough in this process that we don't know how she's going to be treated by the Biden campaign. Now,
right.
And I know you remember this, but one thing that has not gotten any attention, it seems to me, in the conversation about this is, I think Rebecca Traister touched on it in her piece, where the burden to absolve Joe Biden of this is going to fall on the very women or type of women who, are most sensitive and upset about this.
Right.
And it's going to fall on his vice presidential nominee, who he's already said is going to be a woman. But what I have not heard talked about is And I don't know how much this dynamic is playing, but one of the things I remember in the wake of Bill Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman. And it's not the exact same. This is not an apples to apples comparison, but it does seem to be the silence from the Biden campaign about this is reminding me of what happened when so many people went out there to defend Bill Clinton and then had their legs cut out from under them, weeks later. And I think that sting is still there. And I think you're absolutely right. This is a question. In some ways, the real test for Joe Biden, because we can never know the reality of this, is how he handles this now. And it's he should come out and make sure that it is on him to discuss this. It's not on Kristen Gillibrand. It is not on
Warren or Abrams
or anybody else, or Klobuchar. It is on Joe Biden, and he's got to come out and both, I think, acknowledge the seriousness of the allegation. I think he's also got to have an answer of what happened in that office, because something happened. Something happened. It may have been innocent, very innocent, but something happened enough so that her job was switched and she told her mom that there was a problem with my boss. And the mom was upset enough to call into Larry King. Like, something happened. They need to provide that answer to the American public, and particularly the Democratic Party. And he needs to come out and say, like, look, we're not going to answer the questions. Nobody else has to answer these questions. These questions are for me and my campaign to answer. And right. in some respects, like that test, that to me is the test, because you know, I don't know that we can answer this from a moral grounds as to whether or not he is guilty of this. I just don't know that we're ever going to know. You know, we could have some type of investigation, I guess, but with, you know, there's no time. This is not like, you know, I think Al Franken should have gone to that ethics committee investigation. He made the choice not to. There was a lot of pressure, granted, but he made that choice. There's no similar dynamic. You know, we saw it with Keith Ellison, maybe, but I just don't know that we have the time, frankly, for that. He's got to come out and make the case, essentially, right. to the Democratic Party, so that the Democratic Party can feel comfortable that when we get to August, when we get to September, October, that this isn't going to be a political liability of what it looks like it could be. And if he's not able to answer that, then the same people who, and I'm looking at you, Barack Obama, and I'm looking at whatever the, you know, the other people that convinced everybody, you know, at that point to drop out of the race and endorse Joe Biden, they need to step up because they own this. And, you know, so Joe Biden has a moment where the test is on him. Yep. And if he can't do this, then somebody's got to step in. And then, yeah, it's going to be ugly. And I think, like, and then really, frankly, the leadership, the call, the need for leadership, if Joe Biden does, in fact, you know, fail this test, the need for leadership then shifts to the other contenders in the race. And they've got to step up and do something that avoids the crap show that you're talking about in the convention. Because it's not like, you know, and I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, but Bernie Sanders is a distant second. I think numerically, theoretically, he could win at this point if Joe Biden completely evaporated tomorrow and, you know, his name was scrubbed from everything. I think there's enough delegates. It's close. But nevertheless, I don't think that gives you any type of automatic entree into the nomination. And this is a very different situation. And I think then, you know, like the need for leadership moves to someone like Sanders and maybe others in that race to sort of work it out on their own on some level and come out and say, hey, we're making an announcement tomorrow. I'm throwing in with this person or I'm throwing in with that person. I mean, that's the only way out of this, it seems to me. It starts with Joe Biden's test. He's got to pass it or fail. And then it moves on. Like, you know, people got to, there's got to be some grownups here. Like the risk here is enormous.
It's enormous and more enormous than it's ever been. I mean, this isn't the first time this stuff has happened, and some people fail and some people pass these tests. I mean, look at Gary Hart. He crumbled under, you know, similar, you know, a sex scandal. Bill Clinton, who first faced his sex scandal during the primaries in 1992 with Jennifer Flowers, and that whole thing came out, and he handled it in a way that got him through, and he ended up winning. And Barack Obama with his, you know, Reverend Wright situation, yep. which was very grave threat to him, and he handled it really, really well, and it saved him. It's that moment, right? And I mean, maybe it really is a test of leadership. You're faced with this kind of stuff, and you got to figure out a way. Now, the stakes are immensely higher now than I think they were in any of those races. I mean, all presidential races are high stakes. I mean, anything can happen, right? They get the nuclear code, so, you know, it's all high stakes. But this is particularly high stakes. I mean, we've got 30 million people out of work right now. I mean, that's unprecedented. It's absolutely mind-boggling to even wrap your mind around that. And the fallout from that is going to be extreme. So the test has never been more important. And I'll be looking for that, too. I mean, I think that he has to address it. I think he has to do it the way that you're talking about. I think he has to do it with a tremendous amount of sensitivity toward not just the women who everybody's going to look to and force them to answer for whatever this is and put them on the hot spot, as Rebecca Traister said, but also the woman herself, who, you know, whatever you think about her, he has to find a way to show respect for her situation, regardless of whether or not it's what she says he did, just simply because that's, you know, women are going to be hearing this, and he's got to find a way to do that. It's not easy. It's threading a needle, especially if he feels, you know, if he's defending himself and saying, you know, this didn't happen. But the fact is that, you know, and in fact, look back to Bill Clinton. As, you know, as terrible as that whole situation was, one of the things that he did do that was very smart, and only one of his aides really went out and broke that promise, which was that he didn't get up in front of the country and ever say anything mean about Monica Lewinsky. He never did that. In fact, at one point, I think it was in one of his testimony, whether it was grand jury or whatever, he says, you know, well, I think she's a good girl. And, you know, this is my doing, and I think I kind of always knew this was going to happen. And I always thought that was smart of him because, you know, you can't, if the minute that, you know, some powerful man goes and starts, you know, insulting a woman or in some way demeaning her in that situation, it's a terrible thing. All it does is, you know, force everybody to cringe. So I'm hopeful that they will find a way to do this and give Tara Reid some sense of dignity in the whole thing.
Yep. Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Some way to sort of be, you know, come out of this, you know, with her own sense of self preserved in the whole thing. And it's very important that they do this right. It couldn't be more important, Sam. It's the most important thing in the world, because otherwise, you know, if this race turns into a calamity, you know, the world, it's the fate of the world. Seriously, I mean, this is that serious.
And you know, I don't even want to get into my assessment as to whether Biden is up to the task, frankly.
But I don't either.
That's just too disturbing. But I agree with you. He needs to go out there, and I think he needs to acknowledge that there are going to be people in the Democratic Party. There are going to be people there are going to be Americans who go to vote who are going to believe that they are voting. They have a choice between two people who have records of assault, sexual assault against women. And I think he has to acknowledge that and say, you know, I can't change that. And it is unfortunate because I know in my heart I didn't do it. What, something to that effect. And I feel badly for Tara Reid, who is carrying this with her. And I feel badly for Americans who need to go to the polls and make a decision between two people like that and have to ignore those aspects, because I consider myself, you know, someone who has always, you know, took pride in my integrity and my respect for other people, et cetera, et cetera. And but, you know, we also have many other issues that, you know, people are going to vote on. And it is, you know, gravely saddening to me that people won't have that clarity. But I think he has to acknowledge it because people believe it. And, you know, it is, I don't know really what I believe. Like I say, like, you know, usually in these situations, I am for an investigation and allow those investigations. You know, I may be one of the few people in the country who refused to watch the O.J. Simpson trial. Certainly the only one who was even remotely close to news. And because I'm not in a position to judge in those, you know, narrow scenarios.
Right.
But I also, I can't argue to people that it's like obvious he did not do it. I think it's a perfectly legitimate perspective to have that he may have or that he did. I mean, I don't subscribe to it, but I don't think you're, you know, anybody's irrational to believe that. And I don't think people are irrational to believe that, you know, maybe she's, you know, she's misremembering. Maybe she's enhancing to get more attention. I mean, there's a whole slew of potential takes that you could have on this. But I think the bottom line is, by hook or crook, I mean, look, you don't get to choose the environment that you run in. And he is not the nominee yet. And part, apparently, of his test is going to be to deal with this. And and at the very least, they have a responsibility to get on with it. You know, hanging out, hanging back, this is not good. This is Joe Biden has a responsibility to go out there, put his best foot forward, be judged upon that. And because we need a nominee who is not hobbled by something that is going to, you know, make it harder for mainstream Democrats to vote for this guy.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I'm sorry, it's a tough situation. I feel, you know, if he didn't do it, I feel bad that he's having to deal with it. But, you know, this is a guy who's going to be the president of the United States, and he's going to be dealing with the worst situation any president has ever come into office dealing with. So this, you know, if he can't handle this, then, you know, we have a bigger problem. I mean, he really, this is not, he has to figure out a way to do it. And that's just all there is to it. And I agree with you. I think that, and I do think it's possible. I mean, I think that, you know, because we just said, there are often these situations in a presidential race where it's really, this is your test. You know, can you meet it here? I mean, are you able to do it? And when they are, it actually strengthens them. And when they aren't, it ruins them. And, you know, I got to say, I mean, I am no Biden fan, as I have said many times. If it had been up to me, he would not be, I didn't vote for him, he wouldn't be the nominee. But considering the situation we're in, I am sitting here hoping that he finds some way to deal with this that can set people's minds at ease to at least some extent and allow us to carry on and you know, win this election and get Donald Trump out of office, because nothing is worse than him. I mean, he's, you know, Donald Trump and what he's doing now. I mean, the world is in danger with him being in there. So fingers crossed that somehow we get through this. It's an awful thing. And God, you know, like I said earlier, let's just put women in from now on, okay? We won't have to deal with this particular thing. We have our problems, but this is not one of them.
I think that would be nice to not have to deal with that that element. That would be for a change.
Very refreshing. Yeah.
It would be very refreshing. All right, let's do this, Heather. We're just about out of time. We got a lot of other stuff to talk about that I don't think we're going to fully get to be frank. So we're going to do something. Let's have you come on the Majority Report this week. And we will talk about those other things. Maybe we'll have to do a head nod, but we should say, just, you know, just to tick it off, there's a dynamic that is developing where the president has pushed for the openings, that red state governors have pushed for, you know, openings, as it's called. And really, and the governor of Iowa really let the cat out of the bag when she said, hey, we're going to say that we're open. Your employer is going to call you in. If you think it's too dangerous, you get kicked. You don't get unemployment. And then in Washington, Mitch McConnell says, if we're going to do any more aid, we are going to do. And I guarantee you this is going to be retroactive. There will be no liability for employers who call their workers in, insist that they work, and then they get COVID-19. There's going to be no recourse. OSHA is basically shut down as far as I can tell. So there's no sort of like federal watchdog. There's going to be no deputies in the form of tort lawyers if Mitch McConnell has his way. And then Donald Trump comes in and says, I don't want to give any stimulus. Let's just cut Social Security, which of course does not, let's just take, you know, cut Social Security taxes, which does not help people who are not working, and ends up, putting pressure and becoming an excuse to cut Social Security down the road. I mean, we're watching the squeeze big time. And that's something I think we can go into quite a bit on the Majority Report Friday afternoon. And you've written a great piece on, the new Confederacy. maybe this is the way that we get a couple of different countries out of this.
I said this the other day, I think, when you and I were talking last week or the week before, you know, and we were kind of working ourselves up, and I said, you know, it feels like the country's breaking up. And, you know, you look at this and the way this whole thing is coming down and the way that people are sort of these governors are having to kind of band together and they're having to fight against each other in some cases. And I mean, the whole thing.
And they're getting their own cops to protect, like, supplies that come in.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, Governor Hogan of Maryland, and he's a Republican. They asked him today, you know, well, are you worried that the federal government's going to come and seize the masks that you got, that you sent your wife over to, because his wife is Korean, you sent your wife over to Korea to bring back? And he said, well, no, we've got them guarded by the National Guard. I mean, we don't think that they're going to come, as if the federal government is going to, I don't know what, send in the Marines or something to seize the masks. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with, and it's absolutely astonishing. And, of course, you know, I mean, the point of the piece that I wrote about this, about the Articles of Confederation, is that, you know, the Articles of Confederation, which, you know, preceded the Constitution, they didn't have a president. And the fact that it didn't have the president was one of the big reasons why they went ahead and wrote the Constitution, because they realized the country didn't function without some in an emergency. In those days, they were worried about war, but it could be anything, right? Like a pandemic, maybe. That you can't function as a country unless you have a central government and a leader that's doing it. So they went back and they, you know, created the executive branch and the judiciary. But in those days, they didn't have it. They just had a Congress that meant, you know, that met once in a while. They had no ability to tax. There was all kinds of things. So, I mean, here we are. The truth is that we don't have a president. We don't have one that's actually functioning. What we have is this performance artist who's out there saying a bunch of stuff, and basically he's got some people flailing around doing, you know, nothing of any real consequence and essentially standing in the way of others trying to do things. And so, you know, the Constitution, it's not functioning at the moment. And, I mean, this is really kind of startling. I don't know that we've ever seen this. I mean, even the Civil War was a completely different thing. You know, we did have a president who was working.
Yep.
I mean, this is really, really new. I mean, when we look back on this, we're going to see this as Donald Trump's presidency as one of the great, great threats to the Constitution that we had, right up there with the Civil War. I really think that's true.
To our national integrity. And, you know, I can't help but remember conversations that you and I had on this show on the Majority Report in the wake of Donald Trump's election. And I know that we would say something to the effect, we would end a couple of these conversations with, well, I guess we're going to see if the U.S. government can just work and function on its own. We're finally going to get an opportunity to see if, like, is it really important your president knows what they're doing and are decent. And I feel like he almost made it. You know, like, there was no big crisis and no big test, but man, oh man. Well, we'll talk more about these things on the Majority Report on Friday, the Friday show. And then, of course, I imagine we will talk more about these things next week on Ring of Fire.
Unfortunate.
Yes, sadly. But Digby, I'm glad that I have you to talk to about it. Thanks
so
much.
You too, Sam. It makes me feel better. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Between the president insisting on calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus, conspiracy theories of a biological weapon originating from a Wuhan lab, and the rise of anti-Asian violence, there's no doubt that this pandemic may have just come at the right time for white nationalists. Here to explain, Scott Nakagawa from The Nation magazine. So, Scott, obviously there's a lot of implications about the time that we're going through now, many of which we, I think, are really just, you know, beginning and maybe even beginning to begin to understand in terms of the economy, in terms of what our life is going to be like. But one of those things that I think has received not as much attention as one might want it to, that you wrote about, which was the implications of this moment for what had been and what is a growing problem in the United States and, frankly, in many parts of the West, and that is a rise of white nationalism. Give me a sense of, like, you know, what you think this moment means to that, I guess, movement.
Well, for the white nationalists right now, this is a kind of viewed as an opening. You know, we have a president who is basically dog whistling racist messages about, conspiracy theories as to why we are facing this pandemic. Those messages are being heard in a variety of ways, but particularly as a kind of a proxy for globalist, which in their world is kind of a code word for Jew. And of course, anti-Semitism is a powerfully radicalizing force on their side. It's the thing they use to justify a kind of white supremacist ideology that says people of color are inferior and a burden, and yet somehow taking over. In their view, we can take over because we are the pawns in a Jewish conspiracy. So all of that kind of messaging has a really powerful effect. And right now, the white nationalists are much better organized than we imagine them to be. You know, during the Obama years, there was a huge surge in white nationalists organizing right before our very eyes, and as we believed ourselves to be post-racial. And they are very well positioned to take advantage of situations like the one we're in, because sheltering in place, effectively just operating underground, is something that they've had to do for a very long time now. They have a very dense array of social media sites and websites that they've been using for a while now to recruit their base and to get them organized and ideologically trained. So what we're just now beginning to learn how to do from the left, which is to organize online, they've been doing for a very long time. So, you know, coming out of this, there may be a significant surge in white nationalist organizing. You know, I go back in this work to the 80s, and in the 80s, one of the ways that white nationalists and neo-Nazis organized young people was to take them out on gay bashing forays. It was a way of kind of stealing them and testing them and also kind of, you know, ginning up bigotry. That kind of thing now is a situation that many Asian Americans are facing. Suddenly it is the case that anti-Asian American racism is mainstream and being legitimated by our president. So, you know, the opportunity is there for them to take advantage of Asian Americans and anti-Asian sentiment today, like, you know, the neo-Nazi skinhead movement did in the 1980s.
I want to circle back. I mean, there's a lot obviously to talk about, but I want to just to walk through that the dynamic of the white supremacist being able to both believe that non-white people are sort of genetically inferior, however, be able to maintain this dynamic of, and they're beating us. That's where they bring in the Jew, right? The Jews are the ones who are orchestrating that whole dynamic. I mean, I just want people to understand that. I mean, it sounds insane to us, but I guess what happens with these people is they're down a wormhole and they're surrounded by people who have the same thing. And I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, relative to the things that we see today, just broadly speaking, that are widely held beliefs, that type of insanity doesn't sound so insane. I mean, it sounds insane, but it's, you know, like, there's a significant portion of people out there who that's their worldview.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, major social movements have been built on less, right?
Right.
But this, you know, belief about this international Jewish conspiracy is one that has lived on the right for a very long time. So, you know, when you saw those tiki torch bearers in Charlottesville saying Jews will not replace us, this was not a kind of novel new idea to them. This is something age old and well tested in terms of radicalizing ideology. So, you know, I mean, it is true. People of color are a minority in this country still, and have less wealth as an aggregate, and are viewed by them as inferior. And yet they believe we are taking over. And this Jewish conspiracy is the thing that reconciles those two contradictory ideas.
And so
it is a so very important radicalizing force for them. And the fact that Jews are perceived to be a privileged minority in the United States only helps to enhance their sense of the threat.
And so when they say Jews will not replace us, they're not concerned that Jews are going to be the replacements. They're complaining that Jews are orchestrating their replacement with non-white people.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. All right. And then the other point that you made was that we all are now playing on the white supremacist playing field, as if like the stay-at-home order has become an equalizer. It's almost as if like they've been training at high altitudes, and we have to play this game now. Everybody's been, you know, shipped off to Denver, and they're the home team, as it were. And we're trying to get used to this altitude in terms of their ability to network and to create, I guess, to expand their movement at a time where they don't have the competition from people who are able to do it out in the open.
Yes, and we have to keep in mind that, of course, they played an important role in the election of an American president.
Right.
So it's not exactly as if they're completely marginal. You know, increasingly they are being invited into the Republican coalition as their key constituency and becoming players along the lines of the Christian right.
So, do we have a sense of like how they are, you know, what their agenda is, at least short term and tactically during this time? And is this just a question of complete opportunism? The president has led the way with attacks on China. We should also say, he's been criticized for this, at least in some corners, that Joe Biden sort of played into that same frame on some level. I mean, I'm not making an equivalence here, but on some level, what Biden did in his ads was to sort of accept that frame to some extent, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, basically, he, you know, echoed his opponent's message, right? Which is, I think, a big mistake. You know, we really are in a situation of some danger. I think that the white nationalists are likely to try to use this opportunity to, you know, really up their level of organizing. The thing about it is that, you know, that thing about them being so good at being on the internet does mean that they are very steeped in virtual reality. And that is in some ways an opportunity. We see this playing out now, right? With some factions of the far right and white nationalists demanding that, governments be opened up, that, you know, communities be opened up while this COVID-19 pandemic is still, you know, alive. And so, you know, that's a very unpopular battle cry. So they are, you know, presenting us with these little bits of openings that may be the result of their kind of overreaching. So we should be looking for those opportunities as well. And, you know, as tragic as it is that there is this situation of anti-Asian violence now, according to one report, 30% of Americans apparently have seen this kind of harassment happening. The reality is that kind of hate violence and harassment can be an opening for us as well, because most people oppose that kind of thing, right? And so to the extent that we can take advantage of these opportunities, we should. We should try to, you know, take advantage of the increased violence and harassment being directed at Jews and at Asians, and try to reach for police accountability in order to try to isolate this most radical faction of the right.
What do you make? I mean, I get your point that they're in a position to overreach because they don't really deal with normal people for that, I guess, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, than, you know, enough, essentially, that they're sort of hermetically sealed and they're they keep telling themselves certain realities which aren't exactly real. But what was their agenda in this opening up? I mean, what's the dynamic between them and the Trump administration, which is trying to push this right-wing Republican state governments, you know, Iowa, Texas, Georgia, these places, at least in part, are definitely pushing, getting out ahead of their skis. I mean, if I think objectively speaking, but also if you want to go according to the administration's own guidelines, about 14 days of infections going down, getting out ahead of their skis. I think part of that is so that they can diminish their unemployment numbers. But I think there's also an ideological driver to this, in this notion that the founding fathers, you know, would never have allowed the government to do, you know, infringe upon their ability to associate with who they want. Even Mike Pence not wearing a mask at the Mayo Clinic seems to me to be, you know, he is basically showing, he's waving a flag. And I'm curious as to, like, how do they all see themselves within that? Because on some level, they ideologically are they're aligned, but they're even tactically, it seems like they're aligned on some level.
Well, you know, the place where there's alignment between all of these various factions, from the apocalyptic right-wing Christians to the white nationalists to people like Pence and Trump, is that they share an agenda of collapsing government. And so this anti-government agenda is being articulated right now. They're basically trying to put out a populist message from the far right about, you know, these shutdowns, right, that government should not be able to rain tyranny on you in this way, that they will impoverish you, that this is all a hoax. All of those kinds of things are ways of their trying to position themselves as the populist in this moment, opposed to authoritarian measures being taken by our government. And I think in that they may be misjudging just how much the public is leaning into that kind of authority and taking comfort in it, and the extent to which we view liberal governors at this point as the best protectors.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess we will have a better sense of what happens. And I guess let me just ask you, pose it to you this way. You know, what is there a fear that we come out of this and they have been able to accelerate their organization in such a way that we're going to see, you know, some of what we saw during that, what seemed like a surge a couple of years ago after the Trump victory, where there was just a lot more public expression of this type of white nationalism?
Well, you know, I mean, the cautious view is that they're going to come out swinging, and they're going to come out swinging in part because the obvious fragility of our systems that has been exposed in this time is invigorating, especially to the side that has a revolutionary agenda. And so, you know, these are genuine radicals. So as we come out of this, I expect them to step up what they've been doing already. And we may see something along the lines of what we saw right after the Trump election. That in this period of time may be particularly dangerous. And so I think, you know, we need to be really cautious in how we respond to them as they come out of hiding. It's easy, you know, to fall into this notion that how you defeat a violent right-wing offensive is to stand off with them. But the reality is they're trying to bait us into those kinds of confrontations because they play well for their side. So I think, you know, we need to keep that in mind. We need to keep in mind that, for example, the white nationalists include organizations that are made up of military veterans and former first responders who are attempting to infiltrate government agencies like rural county sheriff's offices, and are doing that with some success. In Oregon, some report that perhaps the majority of rural county sheriff's offices are either under the influence of or infiltrated by a white nationalist organization that works particularly with that constituency. So that's the kind of context that we need to recognize we are in, and know that the best way to defeat a violent right-wing insurgency is to be the majority.
Scott Nakagawa, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot.
Nation contributor Scott Nagagawa is a senior partner in Change Lab, a national laboratory of racial equity innovation, a senior fellow on nationalism, authoritarianism, and race at Race Forward. You can read his new article for White Nationalists, COVID-19 Came Right on Time, over at thenation.com. Early in the month of April, a plane loaded with a million K95 masks were on their way from Hong Kong to the New York City area, but that shipment was delayed. Here to tell us about the incredible story of what happened, Josh Kavensky from Talking Points Memo. So, Josh, let me just start off by saying that two things. One, you guys at Talking Points Memo are doing amazing reporting in regards to this specific issue of the way the U.S. government procured personal protection equipment, essentially, and disseminated it theoretically to the states, and also their intercepting of shipments that were set up by states so that the feds could put it back into their own system. I want to start by saying that and just give you guys a congratulations. And I also want to say that the really unfortunate thing, and we could talk more about this maybe once we go through some of your reporting, is that there is no Democratic Party, no opposition party that seems to feel like their job is relevant enough to perform any oversight, who could basically take everything that you have been working on and begin hearings 3 weeks ago, as far as I'm concerned. But let's get to this story that you wrote about the shipment of millions of N95 masks, and then we will branch out from there. But give us the basic background that we need to understand about what has been happening with the entire supply lines of this and the air bridge and everything that's been involved in this.
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having me on, Sam. I think to start off, you know, people need to understand the extent to which there's a crisis just in terms of lack of protective equipment. That's, you know, been an issue that was kind of seen before the pandemic began and has existed throughout the pandemic. It's that hospitals, local governments, and the federal government just don't have enough protective equipment to keep doctors and first responders safe as they treat patients with COVID. So what's basically happened is that you've had random brokers, random people who have ways or who claim to have ways of getting huge amounts of masks kind of pop up around the country. And some of them operate in the shadows. Some of them operate, you know, not in the black market, out in the open. But there are these huge just sort of informal networks by which big amounts of masks and other kinds of protective equipment are being funneled into the U.S. There's a lot of price gouging going on, and there's also honest people involved as well. But the big picture is chaos. And the other piece of that is you have a federal response that is not really doing its job in terms of kind of filling the gap in terms of the amount of protective equipment like masks. So what the government has tried to do over the past 2 months is stand up a thing called Project Airbridge, which you mentioned. And that the idea of that is basically the government is going to start shipping huge amounts of masks in from China to the United States. It's the government's underwriting flights, cargo flights, moving the masks or other kinds of things like sanitary gowns or gloves or whatever from stockpiles and factories in China to the U.S. But it's like, I mean, the U.S. is kind of a leaky boat in terms of the amount of masks. So it's it's not, the holes aren't really being plugged. What is more alarming than that, I mean, because that's sort of a story of incompetence and lack of organization, are these reports that have been popping up for around the past month, which is that, you know, for private buyers like hospital systems or state and local governments who are trying to, you know, by their own connections, bring in huge amounts of PPE, so protective equipment, that they keep having shipments seized and diverted by the federal government. And there have been reports of this around the country. So there was one in California like a few weeks ago where a bunch of doctors got an email basically saying that the government, FEMA, had taken their sanitary gown supply. There's a crazy account in the New England Journal of Medicine, which I wrote about because it connected to the story, where a Massachusetts doctor was trying to personally shepherd this shipment of like hundreds of thousands of masks, and the FBI kind of randomly showed up and he had to talk his way out of it. There's some sense of where masks are all going, but in terms of the story that we got. We got a tip from somebody in the government and obtained emails to effect showing that the government had invoked a law called the Defense Production Act to seize a shipment of masks that was moving from China to the U.S., which kind of told us that the government was using the one legal authority it really had in this area, which is this basically wartime law, the Defense Production Act, to take a shipment of masks. And so based off of the information we got, we had access to customs data on the shipment itself, and that was able to kind of get us to the importer, the people who actually ordered the masks, and who had to deal with the FBI and Homeland Security and all these different people who basically raided their, like, who basically, you know, entered their office, just went, knocked on the door one day and said, "Hey, we're here. You have masks. Like, let us in." And the story we ended up doing kind of tells a story about how this company managed to sort of talk its way out of that, and how part of the shipment was going to the same hospital in Massachusetts that was had initially ordered the masks. But it also kind of illustrates the extent to which it's chaos and the extent to which the federal government's actions in terms of randomly seizing or at least sending agents over to, you know, intimate that they're going to seize masks compounds the chaos.
Yeah. And now, I mean, here's the part that that there's this is twofold. It is one, you have the federal government seizing masks. Now, if we had a situation where we thought like, oh, OK, I'm buying a million masks because I'm going to put them on eBay and I'm going to sell each one for $12. And then the government comes in and goes, no, we're going to seize them from you because you are price gouging during a crisis or something to that effect. But that's not, I mean, that's not the story, is it? Right. I mean, the question is like, what are they doing with these things?
Right. And it's really hard to say. And in terms of government justifications, it's also hard to say if some of the price gouging stuff is pretextual or not, because that's often what they're citing when they invoke the DPA in these cases. But in terms of where the masks are actually going, for ones that are seized, there's only been one confirmed instance where we actually know where they ended up. And that was a really interesting case last week with the Veterans Administration, where it's basically the federal government seizing its own masks. The VA ordered a big shipment of masks, and then FEMA came in and seized it. And again, it's an example of chaos, but what FEMA was forced to admit was that they sent it back to the national national strategic stockpile. And that's a whole separate story, because what that suggests is that the masks aren't necessarily being diverted in accordance with need if past trends are any indicator. What past trends since the pandemic has first emerged have suggested is that states that either rely frequently on the strategic stockpile, like Florida or Mississippi, states that are frequently hit by hurricanes, or be more cynical, red states, were getting their stockpile shipments filled and responded to at rates that were way higher than places like New York State and New Jersey or Michigan. I think Florida, you know, we asked for them for data a couple weeks ago, and data we got back was that Florida by early April had gotten three times the amount of supplies that they requested from the National Strategic Stockpile. And in terms of the mask seizures or the PPE seizures, the only destination that anybody's been able to confirm where the government took them was to the stockpile. So the big question now, I think, is, you know, how are the supplies in that stockpile being distributed, and are the, you know, the past trends that were happening early on in the pandemic of them going to states that hadn't really been hit but maybe had been politically loyal to the central government, is that trend continuing or not?
Right. I mean, this idea that Ron DeSantis is keeping his unemployment numbers down. Ron DeSantis is keeping the beaches open.
Right.
We're going to give them a ton of, you know, we're going to say thank you by taking other people's masks and giving it to him. There's another dynamic here too that was revealed, I guess, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. I can't now. It's out the window for me. But where the admiral who was in charge of, I believe he was an admiral, in charge of the air bridge, in charge of the supply lines, was basically saying is that the U.S. government, and I guess presumably the military, was procuring, let's say, PPE, personal protection equipment, around the globe, and then bringing it back and ostensibly, in the name of efficiency, handing it over, and I'm unclear as to whether they would sell this stuff or what, to medical distributors to provide the distribution, presumably, to all the hospitals because they have the pre-existing relationships. That's what the supply lines look like. But from the state's perspective, what was happening is that they were just basically auctioning it off to the highest bidder, not following any type of plan as to who needed what, not following any type of like list of priorities, like New York's hit the worst, they need this stuff, and not confining themselves to just the United States, but actually selling some of it back to different places around the globe. To what extent do you have anything to add to that dynamic in that story?
I mean, it's just this like horrible collision of like real, you know, social Darwinist, like free market economics with a pandemic. So as you said, yeah, I mean, that is it. They're going back to the private sector and the private distributors are allowed to sell them for their own profit as the federal government underwrites the transit costs from China to the U.S. So because of that, you've seen things like all these, you know, poor hospitals in New York have been unable to get PPE. You have nurses wearing trash bags, whereas the ones in Manhattan, or at least in the wealthier parts of Manhattan that cater to a richer clientele, have been fine in their supply. So the effect of it is to exacerbate, you know, social inequalities already exist, but not only in terms of the patients, but in terms of the doctors who are providing care. So if you're a doctor who's treating patients in a poor hospital or a hospital isn't able to, you know, kind of jockey for the right position in these supply chains, you're much less likely to have the equipment you need to protect yourself while treating these patients. So, I mean, it ripples throughout the supply chain, and it's not just kind of a accidental, you know, byproduct of some system that nobody really designed. I mean, this is the federal policy to do this.
And it's a new federal policy. I mean, let's just to demonstrate just how grotesque this is. I mean, it seems to me that we talk about underwriting this thing. That means that essentially the U.S. government is fronting taxpayer dollars, right? And presumably they're getting those back from the distributors they give it to. But you mentioned the Defense Production Act. It is certainly within the statutory authority of the federal government to say to these distribution, like, I can understand, okay, the Army doesn't have the ability to get stuff to get stuff as efficiently to every hospital in New York State as maybe, I don't know, I'm just picking a name out of the hat, McKesson, you know, because they have pre-existing relationships in terms of providing medical equipment to these hospitals. But you could, under the Defense Production Act, simply say, all right, here, you guys are in charge of distributing this. You get a 4% markup. That's it. Period. End of story. 4% markup. And here's a list that we've gotten from the governor of New York State. And here's where they need stuff. You do the job. We give you a 4% markup on this. I mean, presumably that's the way it's been done in the past on some level, right? And certainly they could have done it that way as opposed to saying, make as much money as you can off this, guys.
Yeah, I mean, reading about the Defense Production Act is that it's like fairly routinely invoked, just, I mean, in defense production, but it's very weird to see it just kind of randomly be pushed into everyday products in the private sector like we're seeing now. But I think it's like worth emphasizing that the powers it gives the federal government are just like unbelievably broad. Like, as you said, I mean, they can go in and they can force companies to give them whatever supplies they deem critical. And they can do that like two ways, one which are kind of interesting. One is by what's called priority ratings. So it basically puts the government at the front of the line in terms of contracts. And the government determines what a fair market rate is, and the company is forced to sell to the government at a fair market rate. The other thing is like what's called the allocation authority, where the government takes things that have already been produced and just sort of seizes them, and they'll pay the producer or whoever the whole supplies or whatever it is a fee and then redistribute it. But there's like almost no congressional oversight over this. There's built-in reporting, but it's lagging reporting. So there's a committee that has to come up with a report to Congress once a year on how the Defense Production Act was used the previous year. It's built into the law, but they're really, except for the few people in the federal government, in the government who have like visibility into that, in the Defense Department or the Department of Homeland Security or wherever, there's like really just once it kind of disappears into the void of this law, there's almost no way to track what's happened to anything that's been seized.
The only thing that we've seen, I did see a story, I think it was like a Politico story, about a former Republican fundraiser who sent out letters to all his clients. I don't know what it was in the, you know, the third week of March or something, second week of March, saying, hey, I'm out of the fundraising business and I'm chasing my dreams to be a medical equipment distributor, and was boasting in this article of having the largest access to 100 million N95 masks or something like that. And they were asked by the reporters, like, how did you start this business so quickly? And he said, relationships. Do you know anything about that? Like, I mean, is there, if we ever get a Democratic Congress, an opposition party, to return to Washington to do their, I guess, non-necessary jobs, according to them, and they start to perform some oversight. All of these are huge ifs based upon what I've seen so far. But if they do that, are they going to find that basically this was just a way for allies of the White House to skim a big chunk of change off of the delivery of these desperately needed medical supplies?
I think, you know, the problem for Congress investigating this is that the Trump administration is going to continue to stonewall in the same way they've stonewalled all oversight since this Congress came into session, where they would have a pretty, I think, easy or like low-hanging fruit in terms of investigating what happened would be to all the private sector companies and state governments and hospitals who've had supplies that have been seized. As far as we know, Congress hasn't made any kind of investigatory requests regarding this, any of those entities. But, I mean, that would tell you a lot about at least where the supplies are being taken from. You know, the other point there is that, like that lobbyist you mentioned, who somehow had connections to get him 100 million masks, the stories of the people who have gotten involved in this area are very weird. And it's basically anybody who, you know, has some, like, old roommate who knows a guy who knows a guy who has, like, a connection at a factory in China has been able to somehow drum up millions of masks. And as long as they can get funding to charter a flight to move the masks over here, I mean, they're able to go into business. So, you know, with that Republican lobbyist you mentioned, like, it's not clear to me if he was just, you know, lying or puffing himself up or if he actually had these connections. But, it's certainly something that's worthy of investigation.
Yeah.
If you have, like, yeah, I mean, particularly if it's kind of a double-edged sword, right, where you have the government, federal government seizing supplies are being brought in, but at the same time, people can still kind of, like, talk their way out of it on a case-by-case basis. Like, it's very much a recipe for conflicts of interest and wrongdoing. Yeah.
Josh Kavinsky from Talking Points Memo, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Kavinsky is an investigative reporter for Talking Points Memo based in New York. You can read his piece, The Long Strange Trip of One Shipment of Millions of KN95 Masks, over at TalkingPointsMemo.com. The NBA playoffs are postponed. Baseball's been delayed. Fans aren't really sure about the future of their favorite sports. Here to help us fill us in on the world of athletics, Dave Zirin from the Edge of Sports podcast. So, Dave, a couple of things to talk about with you. One, I can tell you that, you know, I spoke to one of the top epidemiologists in the country who had been warning of a pandemic like this for years. He wrote a book in 2017 about it. And he is very much of the belief that we need to be able to learn to live with this virus, this disease, for at least a period of time, because only if we're lucky are we going to see a vaccination within, I don't know, 16 to 18 months. And there's no scenario where we hit herd immunity without a tremendous amount of deaths. And even then, that would be a way off. And so he used as an example of living with the disease, sort of both a description of what a professional baseball game would look like and an idea that he got from a father who was a little league coach on how they would go about doing it. And it is, you know, changing the game in some instances, and certainly, you know, having a live game that there's no audience there. But, I mean, people are looking to sports in some way as maybe consolation prize is the wrong thing, but like that is a big, everybody I talk to are like, if I only had the ability to watch, you know, baseball right now. That would be great. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, so give us a sense of, like, to the extent that we have any leadership in this country doing anything about talking about any of this stuff, what is going on in that regard?
Oh, first and foremost, I think people are looking to sports so they have at least the illusion of normalcy, like some semblance that we're not living in some post-coronavirus apocalyptic wasteland, that there is some sense that we're part of the routines of the past, especially the routines that give us a sense of escape or pleasure. And the way people in sports are talking, I think far too much of it is residing in the land of magical thinking, of this idea that sports can be tinkered with in ways that would allow us to still have sports. Like you would have sports before empty arenas and empty stadiums, or you would have sports where social distancing could be practiced in the dugout in baseball or on the bench in the NBA, which is, of course, silly because once people get on the field itself, all the social distancing goes out the window. And also one of the things that isn't discussed a lot, but what commissioners are saying behind the scenes, is that a lot more athletes have been stricken with coronavirus than we know. It does exist in athletic community. A lot of athletes did not take this seriously. When this first broke out, they continued to congregate, continued to talk. And so there's that question as well. Like, is everybody going to be healthy enough to do this? Or are athletes themselves going to be too skittish to do this? Because one of the functions of higher athletic salaries, which we've seen over the last, of course, 30 years since the advent of free agency, for 40 years, really, in some sports, is this idea that maybe athletes don't want to take that risk. Maybe they're willing to take that 18 months off from actually playing. And then there's another point as well, which I think we have to make, which is that if sports comes back at all, it's going to be without fans. It's going to be without ticket-paying customers. And some athletes I've spoken to have said to me, you know, as much as 20% of our ability, this is what one athlete said to me, one NBA player, 20% of our ability comes from the adrenaline of either hearing the cheers or, if you're in a road game, shutting the opposing team up. And you see, you know, basketball players and baseball players, sometimes they put their finger up to their mouths as if to say shush when they do something amazing in a road game. And losing that will also affect the game. So I wonder if it'll, you know, be the equivalent of ice milk when people are expecting ice cream if it does come back at all.
I mean, and obviously the big motivation from the general public is, I think, like you say, you know, some semblance of normalcy, some reminder, escapism. And from the owners, I imagine it's money.
Yeah. And that's an important thing because so sports, professional sports money, doesn't actually depend on the ticket-paying fan. It depends on TV broadcast deals, local sweetheart cable deals when it comes to baseball, and, of course, their use of publicly funded arenas, naming rights, things of that nature. And should not play games at all means you don't get any of that pie, basically. And that's a real concern from the major sports leagues. Now, it's a little different in college football, where actually they depend heavily on ticket receipts, and they depend heavily on the people in the stands. And what's going to happen to athletic departments in the face of this, given how much leverage money there is, particularly towards big football, is something we're going to have to keep our eyes on.
So, I mean, give me a sense of, I mean, how many of these owners, I mean, so if it's the case that maybe there's less of a push by universities to start this up again because they, you know, to the extent that there's money involved, there's, you need the ticket sales, and I imagine there's a lot more liability to bring back students
yeah.
rather than professional athletes. So, specifically when it comes to professional athletes, like what, how much, I mean, because look, we've seen the Chamber of Commerce, right, is out there promoting open these things up. It is a, it's sort of a twofer in some ways because these companies are getting immunity in terms of exposing their workers and their customers, I guess, to coronavirus. So they basically are socializing any of the costs of them opening up during a pandemic. The states, these right-wing states, don't want to pay unemployment. So it benefits them because they can say, well, if you're not coming into work, then you are not eligible for unemployment. So the Chamber of Commerce, I mean, there's a constituency to open it up in that way. How do we see the constituency of the ownership class pushing to where are they? Like, how aggressive are they being at pushing this? Because look, you know, these owners, they're not going to be the ones who are going to be in danger. What's that?
Right, but it's probably more skittish than one might assume, because you have to remember that. You know, I once had an athlete say to me, his name is Brian Mitchell, a great football player. He once said to me, he said, we're different than typical workers, not just because of our salaries. We're different because we're labor, but we're also the product of our labor. So it's like we're a cook, but we're also the steak that the cook puts on your plate. Like we're the chef and we're the steak. And there are a lot of owners who don't want to risk the steak, even if they don't care about the cooks. You know, they've invested millions of dollars in these athletes, and it would be both a PR nightmare, but also a team nightmare if these guys get sick for long periods of time, or, you know, even if they don't die, if the disease degrades their lungs to the point where they can't compete to the degree that they were able to before. So there's some skittishness, even though they want that TV broadcast money and they want that, that cable money, they want that badly. But there is also the concern about the players, not from a humanitarian standpoint, but strictly from an investment standpoint. As for the players, it's interesting. You know, people might know that even with the big salaries, you know, a lot of players do end up broke because they become over leveraged on things like houses, cars, material items, taking care of family members. So there's some concern I've heard on that front from players about their own financial, you could say, lack of planning leading up to this. But also, you know, I emailed with Michelle Roberts, the head of the National Basketball Players Association, and she's doing a terrific job trying to look out for players and their safety going forward. But she said to me that, you know, a lot of the players are also anxious to get back. I mean, this is their livelihood. This is their job. And, you know, you only have a short time in which you can play. And so a lot of them are really thinking, you know, come hell or high water, you know, I do want to get back on that field, on that court.
Yeah, you know, I guess it's because I have I am a little bit New England Patriots centric, but I have been wondering, you know, what it must feel like to be Tom Brady, knowing that you're eking out a couple more years. And Gronk coming into to Tampa Bay, and then suddenly you got to train really for another year before you get to play for them. I mean, it appears anyways.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the NFL, I think, is going to be the most aggressive at getting some kind of product out onto the field. They've made that very clear. I think they're going to be, you know, clinging to the idea that they can, even if it starts, like they're coming forward with all these contingency plans about starting late, doing it, even talking about how they would do social distancing in stadiums. But for people like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who said on Wednesday that, you know, people might have to get their head around the fact that they could have a full year without sports. Not a full year without, you know, spectator sports, people in the stands, but without sports as a whole. And I think the NFL, they're not ready to cede to that, and they want to figure out a way to do it. But, you know, you mentioned Brady. I'm the opposite of you. I'm no fan of the Patriots by any respects, or Tom Brady or any of that. But I got to tell you, I was excited to see how that narrative would play out. Tom Brady in Tampa Bay, Gronk in Tampa Bay. You know, that's a great story. And as someone who loves the stories of sports, you know, that for me is, you know, I'm upset that we're not going to get it, because even if, let's say hypothetically, they do it with empty arenas and all the rest of it, empty stadiums, it won't be the same. It just isn't.
Right, right. The watching Brady walk into Sullivan Stadium in New England would have been sort of fascinating on some level. But all right, so let's
tell you. Oh,
yeah, go.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Oh, I mean, and I, you know, I don't.
Work.
Well, I just need to also say right up front, I acknowledge the issues with the Patriots, but having lived through the Victor Kiam years and the Lisa Olson years, I feel like I owe it to myself to enjoy these years. So sorry, but not sorry.
You've had 20 of them. You've had 20 of them.
It's true.
Let's also not get greedy, sir.
I'm fine.
But the one thing I wanted to add, it's interesting we're having this conversation at what is the 5-year anniversary of a game played in Baltimore that I covered, a Baltimore Orioles game where they played in front of an empty stadium because of the uprising that took place after the police killing of Freddie Gray. Mm-hmm. They still played the game. They had nobody in the crowd. And it didn't feel like a baseball game.
Right.
So we do have some idea of what it will feel like. And so if people think it's going to be back to a semblance of normality for a rude awakening.
Let's talk about something else that has, you know, I have yet to see this documentary. But when it was released, I think I could tell you the exact like second it was released because of what happened to my Twitter feed. I'm talking about The Last Dance. It's a documentary about Michael Jordan. You had some thoughts on it. I mean, for me, you know, that was the Bird, Magic Johnson, and then Michael Jordan eras were the eras in which I really was focused on basketball. So it's something I am going to watch. But what? Give me some of your initial thoughts.
Well, first and foremost, yes, it's very entertaining. And yes, it's so of the moment precisely because of the coronavirus and that there's no other new sports content. They moved the broadcasting of it from June to April for precisely that reason. So people would have something to watch and discuss. So yeah, Twitter was like a bunch of starving folks grasping for food in the way people were talking about it. My take on it is pretty simple. I mean, Michael Jordan in the NBA had final say over what was shown and what wasn't shown. And so everything we're seeing is through the marketing lens of the NBA and Michael Jordan. It's still plenty entertaining, but it also does some things that, you know, rub me the wrong way. Like Michael Jordan, you know, is lionized. Even his habits, which are caught on camera, but not nearly to the extent that they existed, of bullying his teammates, cutting people down, being the kind of person who, you know, I frankly don't want my basketball playing son to be. I don't want him to be like Mike. But that attitude is lionized in it to a great degree. And Jerry Krause, the former general manager of the Bulls, is portrayed as the great villain. They never mentioned that Jerry Krause died in 2017. And so it almost seems like if somebody was coming upon this for the first time, they would think that, oh, Jerry Krause refused to take part in this, where instead he's painted as a villain, and neither he nor one of his defenders is there to give his side of the story, nor do they want him to give his side of the story. So, you know, that's a problematic wrinkle in this thing that has to be acknowledged. But if you're talking about, let's be honest, pure escape, pure 90s escapism, in the horrors of 2020, I highly recommend it.
All right, fair enough. I will. I'm definitely going to check it out, without a doubt. Still, again, a little Boston centric, so nobody will ever be Larry Bird in my mind. But all right. With that said, I also heard some great news this week that you have gotten a green light to write a book called the Kaepernick Effect?
Yeah, the Kaepernick Effect is my working title. Signed a deal with the New Press to put out this book, or I should say signing a deal with the New Press. But I'm so excited about it. It's about all the people from 2016 to 2018, from high schools to colleges to the pros, who made a decision to use the athletic field as an arena of protest and take a knee against racial inequity and police violence. And there's so many stories. And all I did was I put out a tweet and said, hey, the DMs are open. And I just got flooded. Like, it took me 6 straight hours to go through just the DMs and try to organize them and begin to arrange interviews with all the people. Like, seriously, like 6 straight hours. I was like drinking coffee going through it. And I'm already humbled by the breadth of the stories. I've already done about 5 interviews in the last day. And wow. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And people's stories are so amazing. And the people I've spoken to are really eager to talk about it.
Oh, that's exciting. And so I know it's going to be a while, but give me the it really is just about a resurgence. And it has felt like it's been coming for a while. I mean, as you and I have talked, but certainly over the past 3 or 4 years, it has, it seems like the intensity has been there. Now, on some level, that mirrors society, but it also, there's definitely been an ebb and flow with sports over the years, right? In terms of just how political it is.
Yes. And there had been, you're absolutely right, there had been a bubbling in the years leading up to 2016, particularly on questions of police brutality, influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement, also, of course, influenced by the killings of people like Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Sandra Bland. There was this sense that something had to be done. And then in 2016, after the killings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, that's really what spurred Colin Kaepernick to take that knee. And the thing that I think is getting lost to history is that it became a national movement of athletes who usually we mark as the most apolitical elements in society. And I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I've never thought of a high school football team as being a place of radical dissent. You know, it's usually the opposite. I mean, there's so many stories in the 1960s of like football teams being sent by their coaches to beat up the hippies. But here you have the opposite. You have football players wanting to be part of that chain of connection, of using that platform. And what I'm learning already is, you know, they face, you know, young kids face death threats and all manner of frightening oppression by people who wanted them to just shut up and play. And their refusal to do so, I don't want it to get lost to history. Like, this happened. Right. And I want there to be, like, something solid that says, all right, this is a documentation of what took place.
How much over the years has athletes become political, when they have become political, how much of that has been a function of race? And has it ever been a function of anything else?
Well, it's definitely been a function of issues of gender, fighting sexism, LGBTQ rights.
Right.
What it's always about is this idea that sports is supposed to be this level playing field, and yet we live in a very unlevel society. And so it's the people who have felt that lack of equal opportunity who have emerged on the sports world because they emerge from communities where they feel it. And, you know, and I'm paraphrasing John Carlos and Tommy Smith and their statement from when they raised their fists in 1968 at the Mexico City Olympics. But their statement was basically that sports spreads a lie about meritocracy when one does not exist in the society as a whole. And so that means there's an extra obligation to say, hey, we can be enjoying these games, but don't think just because, random person is a star quarterback, that means that our society is also functioning properly as a meritocracy.
Dave Zirin, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time today.
It's a joy. Thanks so much, Sam.
Dave Zirin, the nation's sports editor, also hosts the Edge of Sports podcast. You can find out more over at edgeofsports.com. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Special thank you, as we always do, to our members, and also a thank you to our free listeners. I want to appreciate those who were free last week and converted into members this week. Every time one of you does it, it makes it possible for us to do this program, particularly at a time when advertising is dried up, The radio industry, obviously, a real problem. So if you're listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. You can also check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. This week on the show, I interviewed a top epidemiologist in the country. I interviewed a historian on the history of pandemics. And I interviewed someone on what's going to happen to our economy over the next 6, 12 to 18 months. Check that over, majority.fm. Also, you can sign up for the AM Quickie. 6 minutes, 7 minutes in the morning, top headline news from a left perspective. Find that at amquickie.com. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.